Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box.
Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. It's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away in the title. I'm here to talk up the stories of film, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, distribution stories, all those ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, well, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. What you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of the podcast where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their body of work or their latest release. And in this case, I've got a returning guest. I've got Gil Kenan, the co-producer and director of Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, previously on this podcast to talk about his directorial outing, A Boy Called Christmas, and also co-writing Ghostbusters Afterlife. We were chatting at the London Junket for the new Ghostbusters film, which arrives in cinemas on the 22nd of March 2024, which is the day this podcast is released. There's not actually an awful lot you need to know in advance of this either, short of the fact I'd spoken to Ernie Hudson just before. I think that comes up at one point. We talked briefly about some of Gil Kenan's other films. I mentioned City of Ember just towards the end of the conversation. But other than that, I think this one's relatively straightforward. We talk about bits that are in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, but nothing that's not in the trailer. And I'm going to set it up, as always, with a clip from the film. The other side of this, you'll hear my interview with Gil Kenan.
I've been waiting 40 years for this. They called themselves Ghostbusters. According to these hacks, they saved the world. No eyewitnesses. And who is found to carry the torch? Descendants of Egon Spengler. You have a miner hanging out the side of a moving vehicle, firing a laser gun indiscriminately.
It has a proton pack.
It's completely safe.
I wouldn't say completely safe.
The Ghostbusters are finished.
Well, overruled.
Sustained.
Thank you.
You the weird guy who buys strange old things?
Correct on both counts.
Buddy, you just hit the jackpot.
What is it?
Better question is, what's inside of it?
So that was a clip from Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I've sat opposite the man who co-wrote and directed it. It's Gil Kenan.
And I know it's Kenan because you corrected me last time, and I've learned.
What if
I've
changed the pronunciation since
that
then?
That would be amazing.
It's Kenan, actually.
Is it?
No. I'll go with whatever you say.
Okay. How do you want to do Gil? Are we going to do Gil?
It's actually a silent G, if you don't mind.
Ill Kenan.
There you go.
It's lovely to meet you, Ill. It's
pleasure.
You're a really hard man to be a jaded movie hack around. I mean, your story is just incredible. And you've been on this podcast before and talked about the three-year-old who left London to go to Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
And just writing, just drawing in picture books and just like just building very, very slowly. Can I almost start at the end?
Yeah,
just
course.
Like,
I die.
Did you? How did you die? I didn't realise it was that podcast, but let's go with that.
It's tragic. Do you want to know what year I die in?
Yeah, of course I do. Who says no to that?
83? What year is that? We can.
1983?
No. I'm projecting into the future.
I understand.
We're going into the end of my story.
I thought you were doing a time travel Ghostbusters film. you died one year before Ghostbusters.
We can start today.
Okay. So, but... That three-year-old, I mean, that person who was... It's a really obvious question, but it's such a human one at the heart of your story. It's just like, if you've gone back to that person who watched Ghostbusters for the first time, and, you know, you've made a Ghostbusters film. What, four people have been able to direct a Ghostbusters film, and you're one of them? Do you capture that? I mean,
it is absolutely... it's extraordinary for me to acknowledge that. I don't think that... this period of going out and talking about a film is a sort of twilight moment in the life of a film. The release, which actually happens in a few hours as we're speaking, release, all in a day's work. But that is actually a moment where you sort of stop with the kind of the celebration / back padding part of it, where everyone's just going around and feeling good about themselves, and you go out and you actually put the story out into the world. It's only really in that moment that I begin to acknowledge the fact that this is something that is complete.
Yeah.
The experience is somehow crystallized. In this moment, I still feel almost like I'm making the film still because we're here talking about it. And so in a few hours, I will be able to take a step back from it all. And I'm not very sentimental, actually, about once I finish something, I do move forward. I feel like it becomes the audience's movie once it goes into the cinemas.
Yeah.
So in a few hours, I will be able to, I probably will feel an immense release of all of the pent up excitement and tension that I've had for this last year making this movie. And it will be extraordinary to think about the kid that saw this movie for the first time at 7 and said, whether consciously or unconsciously, that's the kind of movie I want to see.
Yeah.
That's the kind of movie I want to live in. That's the sort of movie I would, you know, maybe I didn't know this at 7. That's the sort of movie I would want to make when I grow up. And so I just got to make one, and it's the best.
I remember an interview with Jonathan Mostow after he'd done Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. I like Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, but that notwithstanding, he talked about the moment where Arnold Schwarzenegger came out of the trailer all done up as the Terminator and just like, and the bit in the interview he said was, holy shit, I'm directing a Terminator film. And that was kind of the moment where, in the midst of all the 1,000 decisions a day that he was making, he just like, he had that. Did you have a similar moment just without Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No, weirdly, he was there.
Really?
Yeah, he was coming out of my trailer, and I was like, what are you
incredible.
Doing in my trailer? But you can't say that to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He'll pound you into a pulp.
I
had a very similar moment, and I was, all due respect to Jonathan Mostow, he had one legend in his story. I had multitudes of legends that for me, it was a scene. You've seen the film now. You know that towards the end, it's in the trailer, so it's not spoiling anything for anyone. There is a sequence in the film where we basically have a legion of Ghostbusters standing shoulder to shoulder, defending home turf, going up against this an incredible adversary. They don't stand a chance. And I was first so energized in the directing of that sequence because I had to marshal this legendary lineup of actors.
Yeah.
Never mind just the legends, Bill Murray and Ernie Hudson, Dan Aykroyd, Annie Potts, add Paul Rudd, Carrie Coon, Finn Wolfhard, Celeste O'Connor, Logan Kim, Kumail Nanjiani, all...
Miss McKenna in it?
Without spoiling anything. and all of them standing shoulder to shoulder. And I'd never had a chance to even contemplate just how iconic of a lineup that was until halfway through the first actual take of the shot where Paula, my script supervisor, tapped on my shoulder and just kind of pointed at the screen. And it was almost like popping a bubble where I just looked at it, and for the first time I realized the the enormity of the image, that this was actually something that as a Ghostbuster fan, actually never mind as a Ghostbuster fan, as a movie lover, this was actually like a meaningful lineup of characters. And so that was a moment where I had something very similar where it was kind of like a...
That's lovely.
Caught my breath.
But conversely, I get to sit there and enjoy that. You still have to block it.
Yeah. It's
like, which just like, I looked at it, I was just like, oh, that must have been really hard work.
I would prefer to be sitting where you are. It's definitely too much work.
We spoke before in 2021 and you were on the eve of the release of two films at once. And you reflected then, I think it was like 2017, 2018, like the cupboard was almost bare, that you couldn't have foreseen just where you would have been just a few years, you know, beyond that. And I mean, I'll come to you, you've had big successes, you've had films that haven't done so well, which again, you've been candid about in the past. That period of releasing A Boy Called Christmas, very popular film in my house, and Ghostbusters Afterlife as well. You said something similar to me at the time, that you're in the zone of it at the moment. Yeah. You couldn't sit back and reflect on it. Did you get like a month after it where you could just think, you know, I did that, or that happened?
I did.
And enjoy it. Even.
And I'm so proud of that moment in my life. I mean, I have to say, you know, because I was candid about this in the past, there was never an expectation for me that one film would lead to another. Each story I tell might be my last one, and I don't take any of this for granted. I also know how many variables come into play just for a movie to exist, period, let alone for somebody who came in from the cold as a movie lover to have clawed my way into a place where now I'm talking to you as someone who's directed a Ghostbusters film. I don't take it lightly. Yesterday was a moment that was really profound for me because, you know, I don't plan to make a habit of this, but yesterday was the 1 year anniversary of us starting a film, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. It was also the cast and crew screening, so I felt like I was presenting the finished film to the hundreds of folks who worked here in the greater Reading area to make this film. It was also halfway across the world, the first day of principal photography on the SNL film that Jason and I wrote. And so the sort of combined experience of what we went through together in that conversation on the eve of those two films coming out and on the cusp of this film coming out, knowing that I at least have one other movie that's going to come out, this SNL movie, I feel really lucky.
So you mentioned Jason there, Jason Reitman, of course, and it's in, you know this is for the benefit of podcast listeners, it was in 2004, I think you said, that you crossed for the first time as he was making Thank You for Smoking, you were making Monster House. Now, during your experience in Monster House, it did strike me afterwards, I regret not asking you this at the time, you must have met so many people through such a big creative collaboration there. Why did this one stick? Why was this still going 6 months down the line?
I've never really taken a step back to analyze why Jason and I work so well together, but I will say that we found a shared passion. And look, a lot of people are passionate about film.
Of course,
but we found a shared way to communicate that passion in a way that I think both of us have found to be unique over our almost 20-year span of, I guess 20-year span of knowing each other. It all comes down to communication, and that might sound trite, but actually you think about marriages that last, across the span of time, any long-term relationship needs as its foundations some way to communicate beyond just the superficial. And with Jason and I, we found a way to share language in a way that that functions. And it happened early on just as friends. It then developed into something where we were able to tell stories to each other, talk about each other's films in a way that felt maybe a little bit more, like there was a bit more depth or substance to it.
Yeah.
And we were able to have disagreements and work That's through those disagreements in a way that I think is extremely healthy. And this is something that has sort of evolved almost without comment in our relationship over time. But as we come to a crossroads or we have an actual, you know, disagreement about where a character or a plot point should go, we're very good at standing up and going for a walk, like moving away from whatever that moment is and changing the environment. I really recommend this, whether or not you're in a creative partnership or not. we found tools to work through obstacles.
It's such a disappointing story. I wanted tridents in the car. I wanted full-on Anchorman.
Yeah,
I wanted
it needs like to get full-on, really violent. You're right. A blood match to the death?
I think so. Right. I think that's only... I don't think to the
just,
death.
Just all just you minor. All you have to do is you hit pause on the recording, you rewind 20 seconds.
I'll edit. That's fine.
I'll get violent.
That's fine. It all gets run through AI anyway now, doesn't it? I mean, it just cuts out all the human stuff and just gets to the nub of it. One of the things from, I look at something like A Boy Called Christmas, for instance, and we saw this in Afterlife, we see it again in Frozen Empire. He's finding very, very big clothes of a film and finding the smallest possible. Smallest possible stakes and the smallest possible stories in there. Mike, I still maintain that the Captain Underpants movie is one of the best examples of stakes in a modern film. It's all about, effectively, two kids who don't want to be separated at school.
It's fantastic. I love that
movie. I love that film a lot. McKenna Grace and Emily Allen Lind, I think I've pronounced your name then. You found this tiny, I know there's a broader family thing going on there, but you found something tiny and really resonant and important there. And that feels to me like the eureka moment.
It absolutely is.
It's, can you tell me how you found that?
Yeah, it's the emotional center of the film, without a question.
Loved it.
And thank you. When you're telling these stories, thematically, of course, you can draw lines in any direction, but you almost always have two sets of layers to stakes, right?
Yeah.
You have the global stakes, and in this case, we have an adversary who has an agenda, has a nefarious way of sort of trying to get to the thing he's after, and does so in a operatic, grand, world-ending sort of way. And then you have the personal stakes, and it's almost always the case that if a movie works, it's really because of the latter.
Yes.
that the obstacles that a character faces at the start of the story, the thing that makes you feel invested in a character's journey, it can be thrilling to watch them have to navigate those global stakes, but it can rarely be meaningful. And so it's the personal stakes or emotional stakes that always create the sort of true engine of a story. And for Phoebe, we knew, not just because of where we were projecting her character to go in this story, not just because both Jason and I are parents of teenage daughters who we had front row seats to the
I'm happy to offer consultation on that as well, if that helps. Very affordable rates.
Now you tell us. but there was this acknowledgement that there in Phoebe and in McKenna, who brilliantly brings her to life, there was a development across time from the last film to this one that was going to sort of organically offer up the opportunity for a character to be searching for something within herself, looking for a way to define herself both within her family, within this new town, within Ghostbusters, and within her own trajectory as a human being. She's a character who feels like she doesn't have a natural fit into the world of ghostbusting, as we meet her in this film. And there is of course, a sort of comic or a tragic irony, depending on how you want to see it, that the one character who she connects with and who sees her is a ghost.
Yeah.
And that's not, it's not as trite as it might sound in the telling of it.
Well, no, you play that matter of fact, don't you?
Absolutely.
It's Groundhog Day. Don't tell us the rules.
It plays totally as you find it.
Yeah.
It also, I think, is not out of the, it's not an exceptional occurrence for someone like Phoebe, who we've demonstrated has an unusual sensitivity, both in her relationship with her grandfather and in her openness, not in a sort of Dan Aykroyd, give me all the stories, feed me the spectacular because I'll believe it all, but something a bit more idiosyncratic. I think for Phoebe, there is a sort of deeply personal connection to the idea of the supernatural. And I'm really proud of the fact that through her relationship with Melody in this film, through her arc as a character, there is for the first time a ghost story with a voice to it. There's a ghost with a backstory, and that creates a separate and I think a distinct emotional dynamic.
I did write down whoever cast McKenna Grace. I mean, that's Christina. Christina Ricci in Adam's Family levels of casting.
You know, Jason Reitman is an absolute genius in casting. There's no question.
You've got an interesting setup with your Ghostbusters as well. I don't know if you're a fan of the Daniel Craig Bond films.
I love Casino Royale.
Right, so Casino Royale, masterpiece. Yeah. Right? I'm not asking you to comment on other people's films, but the narrative arc of that was quite interesting, and the ages of your characters give you options. Owen. And so we got in the first two of those five films a very young and raw Bond. Then we got Skyfall, enjoyed Skyfall enormously, but we went straight to mid-story. All of a sudden, his experience. And no one really talks about year 3, 4, 5. You know, there's always a gap
Absolutely.
As characters develop. You've got, as you said, a lineup at the end of characters of all sorts of ages. As a storyteller, I mean, does that open up in your head, you know, just opportunities that you feel others haven't particularly gone towards?
Yeah, I mean, I think of two things. One is I actually love watching characters aging across stories.
Yeah.
And I think especially when you comment on it can be, you know, we all have relationships with time that whether you want to accept it or run away from it, it's still something that is primary for everyone. It's really joyful to be able to write a story across time for a character.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that those years in between the films actually have development that don't get addressed in a story. It's so cool to be able to drop in and watch somebody arrive at the cusp or within the middle of a new stage of their life. There is a generational story that you can't get away from in Ghostbusters because we're dealing with characters who run the gamut from, you know, 15, 16, 17 to pushing 80.
Yeah.
And
Ernie Hudson is never 80. I've just been in a room with Ernie Hudson. There's no way that man is over 26.
I resent every time that guy takes a sport coat off and stands next to me. It's incredibly unfair.
Yeah, I agree.
And I will never forgive him. But you can't get away from the fact that lived history has both a story to tell for those independent characters and in their relationships with younger characters. And specifically in a film saga like Ghostbusters, where we're talking about 40 years of storytelling, and we've got a story of a young Ghostbuster trying to figure out her role within this organization, and you know, in the place of Dan Aykroyd's Ray and Ernie Hudson's Winston, you have a sort of living conversation about what it means to even still put the pack on at this age, whether it's sensible or
backache.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, is it a ridiculous concept to think of a 70 something Ghostbuster? And they sort of confront that question head on. And I do love that those themes are explored in the film.
I have to say, just as a complete aside, 9-year-old me never understood the lyric. I've always wanted to ask this to a Ghostbusters director. If you're all alone, pick up the phone and call. The rest of the song makes perfect sense, but why, if I'm all alone, should I just naturally ring them up? There's no Ghostbusters film that's explained.
I think it's inferring that it's not just being alone. Yeah, I think it's actually it's holding on to previous lyrics in the song that suggest
it's retrofitting.
There's something strange.
I know what you're...
Look, there's something strange in the neighborhood, and you're all alone. It's an ellipsis.
I mean, the Ghostbusters fan base has been on. I'm not going down this road, there is a reason to it. The Ghostbusters fan base has been on some ups and downs over the last 5-10 years. I'm curious, when you come to make a film, where your head is. Are you recruiting and trying to bring new people on board? I appreciate the answer's always a bit of both, but I just wonder where ultimately your primary focus is. Are you on a recruitment drive, or are you trying to satisfy the people from before?
I mean, I definitely want this to be a Ghostbusters movie. I would love for this to be a wide part of the audience's first Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah.
Like I think that's me putting my check into the latter category. I do want this to be a Ghostbusters movie that can bring a whole new audience in. And I think because it's the first time back in New York City since 1989,
yeah,
within our sort of Spangler saga, and because it's a big old movie, there's a chance to meet some of these characters for a huge part of the audience for the first time, and I'm excited about that.
How do you explain to a new recruit just how long Walter Peck has been mayor for?
Well, first of all,
you must have written that bit.
I will own it. There is an arc to his character. He had a fall like you couldn't believe in the late 90s.
It's everything you said about not what you don't see, right?
He had to claw his way back after 2 failed marriages, a bankruptcy, a public trial. His character was dragged through the mud. Really, we should all be congratulating Mayor Peck for having scraped his way back to that perch.
I'm sure there's a political subtext there of a public figure who's dragged through the courts and makes a comeback, but I'm not going down that road either. Were you a fan of the, I don't know whether you saw it or not, the Disney Plus series, Light and Magic?
Is that the one about ILM?
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah, I've not spoken to a filmmaker who's not seen it.
I was absolutely blown away.
So I read your end credits as well, and your end credits, as much as great big long lists of visual effects artists and things like that, are puppeteers.
Yes.
And I read the press notes as well, and the press notes talk about these practical old style effects that you were looking to do. Now, I read things like this, and I read film directors saying, I love doing it the old way and stuff like that. But what is the practicality to you once you actually have to do it? You know,
well,
that's the bit I never hear.
Okay, so it definitely creates complications, but there is an immediacy to the work that actually sort of...
Oh, I love it, to be clear.
I mean, no, it's not just that. It's immediacy in terms of you actually have the thing that you can then composite into the shot in a way that skips the 3 months of fine-tuning a render to get it to look halfway realistic.
Yeah.
So you're actually, if you get the performance there with a puppet, you know you've got the damn thing. And that's, you know...
That's interesting.
You cannot...
Especially when you were only shooting a year ago.
Yes. And so it actually has a practical application. Slimer is a mixture of digital Slimer and puppet Slimer in this film. And I'm really proud of the fact that it's not entirely clear, even to me, the moments where one ends and the other begins. That's not true. I know exactly where it is, but I do feel like when I'm watching the movie and I'm in a good mood, I can totally give in. I can totally give in to the thing and not be thinking about the technical exercise. It's really hard to direct Slimer. It's funny to do it, but it's hard because it's actually an extremely technical puppet.
Yeah.
It requires one central puppeteer. Kevin was our main puppeteer. And 2 additional puppeteers plus a third. So it's really 4 people that are creating one ridiculous arm-waving performance. Communication is not easy with Slimer. There is foam that muffles audio. Suffice it to say, it's hilarious, but it's challenging.
So, I mean, 2 more things before I'm sure I'm about to be chucked out in a minute. But first of all, can you just say a few words about Britain's own Eve Stewart?
Britain's own Eve Stewart is national treasure territory.
Lovely.
An absolute, she is a general when it comes to creating. Okay, so there's 2 hats to Eve Stewart. One is an incredibly sensitive artist, a designer who is so attuned to character, thinks in an unpretentious way about creating a world, and is able to sort of conjure up just the right tone of world for the story that she's telling. That's the artist side of Eve. The side of her that was able to muster the forces to build this firehouse, to build this lab, all within weeks of me pushing a piece of paper with some words scribbled on it in front of her, is absolutely heroic. That's the side that I was calling the general, because I haven't seen a sort of command of the practical side of building a set in quite that way. Her crews love her. She is a good, kind person. She loves movies. You watch a real thrill in her eyes when a scene is coming to life on her sets.
Yeah.
She's special.
You're a proper Bond villain, though, aren't you? Pushing the piece of paper just across the desk. Do you do it silently?
Yeah. I'm not gonna. I'm gonna put a name of a set on a piece of paper. I'm gonna pass this over to you, and you're gonna build it, and you're gonna do it in 3 weeks.
Oh, that's great. You're a delight. I'm just gonna work for you at some point. You told me last time about that one of the lows was just on City of Ember,
when
you're less taking notes from a lawyer as your film just sits in financial
Thank you
limbo.
So much on the cusp That's of fine. One of the greatest heights no, of no, my career.
No, no, no. See, it's roller coasters
we're
doing. We're roller coaster, right? So, and then conversely, I read just before I come in about Sanford Panitch, the president of Sony Motion Pictures Group. I'm sure you're aware of this person. Talking about how Jason and Gill as co-writing partners have a remarkable understanding of commercial quality cinema, and we're thrilled about the upcoming pipeline from these guys. 7 years apart, that struck me. 7 years apart from what sounded like an absolute rock bottom, which I'm mentioning again just to try and drag you down just a second, but to this remarkable turnaround of how you sit here with, and you're already talking about you've got another film coming, you must have ideas going. Tell me, Ill Keenan, what is it like to be you at this moment in time? Can you actually enjoy it?
I don't know that I can enjoy it yet is the answer. I still feel the stress, the anticipation of about to release this film globally. I think I'm really excited. I was able to sit with my cast just a few hours ago and look each other in the eye and say, we just made a Ghostbusters movie. That felt really good. I feel so proud of where I've come to. I can't forget that moment that we talked about all those years ago, 3 years ago, because that moment did, you know, it did teach me a lesson.
Yeah.
And that lesson was, you can put all of your best creative instincts up on the screen. You can put yourself out there. You can do everything with the best intentions. And there are still elements outside of your control that can create obstacles to being able. Look, my goal, simply stated, is to be able to tell as many stories as I can. That is absolutely the only thing I care about going forward, wherever our next conversation ends up
on
whatever film, because now I know historically you will dredge up
the
darkest moments
that I
share with you. I'll do better at enjoying this, because as I say it, even as you ask me this question, I realize this feels like the therapy session I need right now to step out of myself and just say, like, holy shit, I'm about to release a Ghostbusters movie. And that's a really great feeling. But
you've done something four people in the world have done.
Yeah, it's super, super wild. Thank you for
whether people love it, whether people don't, you've done something four people in the world have
done.
They
better love it. I put a lot of myself
Damn straight.
Into it.
Damn straight.
Thank you.
Ill Keenan, it has been, again, an absolute delight.
Thanks,
congratulations
Simon.
On
Thanks.
Making a Ghostbusters film.
Thank
I don't
you.
Know if you realise you've done one.
Thank
you so much.
That was fun, and I really enjoyed our chat.
And that was my conversation with Gil Kenan, the director and co-writer of Ghostbusters: Frozen Empire, which is now out in cinemas around the world. It brings to the end too this latest episode of Film Stories, this special episode of Film Stories. So it just leaves me to say thank you so much for listening. You can find more from me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. More from Film Stories on Twitter and Blue Sky at Film Stories. You can find us too at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, youtube.com/filmstories. And our shop is store.filmstories.co.uk. Loads of print magazines there for sale. We make print magazines. Imagine that. If you go to filmstories.co.uk, that's updated every weekday as well with movie news, features, reviews, games, TV, all kinds of things like that. We are making a non-clickbait entertainment website, and that's available for you now. I'm going to head off now, though, to put together your regular episode of Film Stories. Thank you so much for listening to this special. Thank you so much for your time. I will be back soon with some more Film Stories. Take care. Bye-bye.